It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. So-called 100 and 500-year flooding events are far more frequent than they used to be. This hour, we're going to talk about how wildlife, wetlands, and water quality are affected by these frequent floods and how we can use this knowledge to lessen the impact of these events in the future. With me today, Department of Natural Resources fishery biologist Scott Gritters. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Charity. Thank you for having me back on your show.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. Also with me, Iowa State University Extension wildlife specialist Adam Janke. Hello, Adam.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Let's talk about what happens with flooding events. Of course, when humans watch flooding events, we tend to watch the waters rise in the rivers that we cross over on bridges. This is the most visible part of what's going on. But before we see those rivers rise, Adam, why don't you start out by talking about what happens before that?
Yeah, so the rivers start to rise, the rainwaters come down and the rainwaters hit the watershed. And depending on where in the watershed the rainwaters land, and what sort of the current state of the vegetation and topography of the watershed is, it starts its track towards the river. And lots of things affect the rate at which the water's going to make it into the river, where we see it and where we start to have the problems with it. And those things are ecosystems like wetlands are really important in holding back floodwaters at higher points in the watershed. So they hit these depressional areas where they have poorly drained soils or topography that prohibits the overland flow of water. And that holds the water up higher in the watershed. And then slowly through groundwater, surface flow, and full wetlands, we'll see the water find its way to the river. And then we also, of course, have plants in the watershed are acting to buffer the impact of rainwater and how much rainwater makes it to the wetland. So we call that evapotranspiration, or ET. And the type of plants that the rainwater encounters will impact, how much water infiltrates the soil or how much water is taken up by the plant, and then how much water is retained and evaporates off before it runs over the soil or through the groundwater and into the river system. So there's lots of stuff going on in the uplands that influence how much water we see in the rivers downstream.
So, of course, the soil is getting saturated, and it's kind of holding on to that water if the water can get to the soil. Of course, in our more urban areas, the water usually or often encounters impenetrable surfaces, right? Like parking lots and streets.
Exactly. Yeah, we have lots of sort of modifications to our landscape that expedite the rate at which the water finds its way to the rivers. And that's, of course, a big challenge that we deal with in flooding. Urban areas are a perfect example of that. No water is getting through traditional concrete. We, of course, have things like pervious concrete that a lot of people are advocating for, but not at a large scale. And so the water hits the concrete, it runs into the drains, and then those drains go straight to the river. So they take anything they find in the parking lot, oil, trash, and other things, right into the river with them. And there's no chance for really substantial evaporation or use by plants or movement of that water into the groundwater. So it's an altered hydrology, we say.
And Scott, as a biologist working often on the Mississippi River, when we have one of these events where there's been a lot of rain and, of course, the water starts heading into the rivers and eventually makes its way to the Mississippi River, and we see that runoff in a lot of urban areas, compare a flooding event now to, say, a flooding event 100 years ago. How much of a difference does that make?
It makes a big difference. I think what Adam was talking about is there's a, historically there's a natural cycle of water level. We've seen this maybe in the spring it floods, a summer low period, and then, a fall rise. And we call that a natural hydrograph. But now with all these, as Adam alluded to, all these changes in our watershed, we see what we call an altered hydrograph, and fish and other aquatic organisms are genetically patterned to this cycle, and now the cycle seems to be off a bit, and it certainly can affect our aquatic animals.
And we'll talk more about how it affects our aquatic animals as the hour goes on. Now, of course, a lot of people have beautiful green lawns as well. I mean, there are so many more houses than there used to be, and there seems to be plenty of green space in a lot of our suburban areas in Iowa. How do lawns interact with water? Do they hold water like the kinds of plants that you were talking about, Adam, or do we get a lot of runoff from our sort of traditional lawns as well?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Yes, we have tons of turf grass in Iowa today, and historically, Iowa was mostly grass, prairie grasses. And so the change in the type of grasses that we have on our landscape today does have an important impact on the hydrology of our landscapes. So turf grasses, things like Kentucky bluegrass and crabgrass, perhaps, that people don't like, have a very different growth pattern. First, they're cool-season grasses, and they're sod-forming grasses. So they are flat across the soil, so it's the only species that occurs in our landscaping, essentially. So it's a monoculture, and then they have really shallow root systems. And, of course, anybody that's ever translocated sod knows that you can just dig up a few inches of soil, and you can plant sod-forming cool-season turf grass, and they do really well. Our prairie plants, the plants that used to occur across Iowa, over 80% of Iowa, have really deep root systems, up to 9-10 feet in some cases. And these are perennial plants. These root systems develop over a really long lifespan of many years. And that definitely has differences in the way that water infiltrates the soil, and also how porous the soil can be. And so as those roots decay, it allows for water to move through the soil in a different way, and we lose that with turf grasses. So and the lower diversity in the watershed and the relatively short stature of our turf grasses allows for reduced evapotranspiration as well. So, yeah, although they're grasses, sure, that's about the only thing they share in common with our native grasses that we would have had. That would have sequestered a lot more water higher in the watershed and also would have had a lot more evapotranspiration releasing that water up into the atmosphere before it hit the rivers.
All right, so they're part of the problem when we talk about runoff in a watershed.
They're part of the challenge, for sure. Any changes sort of to our towards decreased diversity or different structure of vegetation has an impact on what we see in the rivers, for sure.
Now, Adam, I know that you did a lot of research about the prairie pothole region in South Dakota as you were getting your PhD. The prairie pothole region also extends into Iowa, although it doesn't cover the entire state of Iowa. And this is an area with a lot of natural, small, intermittent wetlands. So when that environment had not been altered, how would that have interacted with, say, a flooding event?
Yeah, so the prairie pothole region is appropriately named. It's a lot of these really small pothole-type wetlands. So don't picture a road pothole. Picture something a little bit bigger, of course. But these pothole wetlands could be anything from familiar water bodies like Okoboji Lake is a pothole wetland to really small things the size of a pickup truck, that just a depression in the landscape where water would hold during precipitation events, or in some cases with groundwater inputs, and not make it to stream flow. The prairie pothole region in Iowa, like you said, is part of a larger ecosystem that goes up into the prairie provinces of Canada, out to across the northern expanse of Montana, most of eastern North Dakota and eastern South Dakota as well, and then western Minnesota. And this is a glacially unique ecosystem, and it's really important for wildlife, a globally important wildlife area. And what happened here was that the retreat of the glaciers was just a little bit different. And this is our most recent glaciation, so the Wisconsin glaciation. And the glaciers moved at a different pace that left a lot of small depressional areas in the landscape, different than sort of the other impacts that Wisconsin glacier had in other ecosystems of sort of scouring the landscape and creating interconnected waterways. The prairie pothole region is not interconnected. There's relatively low densities of rivers and streams. And so a lot of the water that falls on the prairie pothole region traditionally just stays right where it is. It either goes into groundwater or in most cases it actually just evaporates out of these shallow, large, flat wetlands. And so we had lots of plants and lots of animals evolve to take advantage of that really unique ecosystem.
But, of course, those wetlands, those little intermittent wetlands, were incredibly irritating for farmers.
Yes.
And understandably so.
Absolutely.
So we did alter the environment in Iowa in particular, South Dakota also, by tiling the fields to make sure that that water flowed away instead of stayed there in a puddle, which could kill your corn or your soybeans or whatever else you want to grow.
Exactly, yes. So that's the big transformation that occurred in the late 1800s and the early 1900s where we developed extensive drainage infrastructure. The thing about wetland soils, particularly prairie pothole soils, is that they developed underneath prairie grasses, and so they're rich in organic matter, which is just perfect soil for agriculture if you can deal with the impediments to production. And in this case, that's water. And so we did. We had extensive drainage. And in Iowa, we've lost over 90% of our wetlands, particularly in the prairie pothole region. Things like surface drainage with drainage ditches and tile infrastructure as well. These wetlands were pretty shallow and they were also fed mostly by precipitation, so not a lot of groundwater impact. So a drain tile could take those surface water inputs out of the ground, put them into a close-by river or stream, and send them out of the way and allow for production in the uplands. And that's really changed our ecosystem in northern Iowa a lot from what we would have found in the early 1800s when we had all these wetlands.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guests today, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist, also Assistant Professor in Natural Resource Ecology and Management at ISU, Adam Janke. Scott Gritters is here, Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Biologist. We're talking about flooding events and how they interact with our ecology and wildlife. You can join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the major flooding events that have become a way of life in Iowa in recent years. We used to call them 100 or 500-year floods. Now we're seeing them every 8, 10, 15 years in Iowa. And we're talking about how wildlife, wetlands, and water quality are affected by these frequent events. Here with me today, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Adam Janke and Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Biologist Scott Gritters. And just before the break, we were talking about the prairie pothole region, and that extends into the state of Iowa. There are all of these little intermittent wetlands that used to hold water when there were wet periods. And, of course, these have been tiled, and the water flows away to allow farmers to farm their fields. And, I mean, Adam, we were talking about, you know, this is something that's been going on now for over 100 years. And, of course, the initial impact of this kind of tiling was nothing but positive for farmers because it allowed them to grow their crops without having their crops drown when there were heavy rains. Today, how much of an impact do you feel that the tiling in farm fields makes on the watersheds?
Well, the positive impacts locally are certainly still there. You take the water out of the field, and it allows for crop production in most places. There are certainly some areas where drainage isn't working or doesn't work because the soils are just too poorly drained, or there's too much groundwater inputs or something like that, and so there isn't the local benefits. The challenges sort of accrue at the watershed scale, as you said. And so that means we have potential for increased flooding, potential for increased what we just call base flow. So just how much water is always flowing in the river or stream. And those things change because of the things we've talked about that wetlands do and that perennial vegetation does. It holds water back. It allows for evaporation or loss to groundwater that doesn't make it into our streams. And so it certainly it certainly is a big challenge, a challenge that lots of people are working with in Iowa today because of things like nitrates and drain tile effluent and these flooding impacts that we're talking about today. So there's lots of players, lots of moving parts, and wildlife, of course, are sort of a part of that conversation, or a small part of that conversation, because they're certainly impacted by wetland drainage and wetland modification.
Well, and Scott, all of the things that we're talking about with the drainage issues in modern Iowa today, whether it's cities with a lot of pavement or the tiles in farm fields or all of those suburban lawns, this all increases the speed that the water is traveling when it hits the creek and hits the river and makes it to the Mississippi. Why does that make a difference, this rush of water?
Well, again, fish and aquatic organisms are really genetically patterned to a rhythm cycle in water pattern flows. And, you know, when we had that prairie pothole and we had the rest of the wetlands throughout Iowa, we'd see this slow rise, and a lot of organisms like fish are adapted to maybe in the spring when they feel the slow rise, they may move in and spawn. And or in the case of like a northern pike, they move into a wetland area to lay their eggs on vegetation, or a catfish may move in to feed. But right now we have this real rapid rise of water levels. It almost occurs instantaneously. How many times don't our phones go off now for flash flooding? And fish aren't adapted to that cycle. They're not adapted to moving in that quickly. And often these flash flooding or rises in river occur any time of year now. We don't just see it in the spring. We see it in the summer. We see it in the fall. And, you know, like last year, Charity, we had one of those events on the Mississippi in January. If you remember, we flooded badly in the state of Missouri on the Mississippi from these changes of water level. Again, it's not generally catastrophic to a lot of fish. Fish are highly adaptable, but it can be in situations where, especially if you're just take a nest builder like a bluegill. It's a common sunfish, most commonly caught in Iowa. And you make a nest, the male sits on a nest maybe in 2 or 3 foot of water, and, you know, in Iowa now, all of a sudden, a day later, that's 10 foot of water. And then, to tell you the truth, 3-4 days later, it's actually dry land. We just see this radical change in our hydrograph, and it affects things like fish and mussels and our other wildlife.
Well, and Scott, you're talking about the different times of year that we see these flooding events. So let's talk about that, because so far we've been focusing on our environment, how humans have changed the environment and how that interacts with flooding events. But we have also seen significant changes in our climate patterns, and that affects flooding events too, right?
Exactly. I mean, they're all interwoven. Urbanization, land use changes. We got nobody but ourselves to point to.
So with these flooding events, I mean, you mentioned January, flooding events used to come kind of predictably in the early spring, right?
Exactly, yep. We've seen a slow spring rise. Maybe that water that hit on the prairie pothole would slowly leak out in the groundwater and kind of act like a sponge and slowly fill up our rivers in the spring.
What other are there other times of year that we often did see high water?
Generally, there was in the fall, we would see a slight bump in the water level. We get a little bit of change of weather patterns in the fall. And this was often a very positive thing for the environment as fish. Generally, the winter period is a really tough period of time for things like fish and mussels. And we, at least we'd see a fall rise where they could, when they go on the feed for the winter, they can exploit some new habitat in the fall.
Well, and as you said, the fish that we have in our ecosystems, their whole instincts, their yearly patterns, all of that had over time evolved to be in harmony with these rises and falls, right?
No doubt. No doubt they did.
We're talking about flooding events in Iowa and how that interacts with our environment this hour. You're welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Scott Gritters, Department of Natural Resources fisheries biologist and Iowa State University Extension wildlife specialist Adam Jenke, and Fred is on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Fred.
Hi there. Several years ago, I was helping the neighbor combine his corn crop, and in a small ditch that feeds into a bear creek here in Powhatan, Iowa County, the beaver had put up a couple dams with corn stalks. I can't understand why they would go into such a small creek where you could jump across it without even trying to dam it up.
All right, so you're wondering what the beavers were up to there. Corn stalks don't sound like the best material either.
It works pretty good for them because they would flood the field and then you have to go in there with a backhoe or something and pull it out, and the next day they'd be right back in there working it up again.
All right. So, Adam, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. So the beaver is just doing what it's sort of always done. It senses water moving out of its environment, and what beavers do best is they stop that water moving out of their environment. And this is a familiar problem and thing that we see a lot in drainages where beavers can occur. And if you think about a corn stalk, particularly a late season corn stalk around harvest time, it looks for all the world probably to a beaver a lot like a willow colony. Lots of young, small stems on the landscape right around the water area. And so a beaver evolved to sense water moving out of streams and to create backwater habitats where it can have more places to feed in dens and in areas to raise young. And those were traditionally things like willows and cottonwoods, things that grow in really tight, dense colonies and are relatively small when the beavers chew them down. And to a beaver, moving water in a drainage ditch with a lot of stems of corn around it probably looks like home and certainly creates a challenge for a lot of folks out there.
Well, and Adam, just very briefly, because I know we can spend a whole hour talking about beavers, but let's talk about what place that kind of behavior used to hold in our ecosystem, because beavers damming up a creek and creating a small pond used to really serve a pretty essential function.
Oh, it sure did. Yeah, beavers are the textbook example, particularly in the Midwest, of what we call an ecosystem engineer. So these are an organism that are right at the middle of creating entire ecosystems that all sorts of other critters rely on. And so beavers, as we've discussed, create these dams and flowing water, and they create those areas so that they can have more areas to forage. They're not doing it for all of the other critters that like beaver dams, but they create these areas where they can raise their young and have reliable food sources, and then all sorts of other critters take advantage of these shallow water wetland habitats that the beavers create. So we see lots of waterfowl use them, reptiles and amphibians use them as breeding areas, all sorts of other types of birds, wading birds and shore birds, but all find use for beaver wetlands. And so they're a really interesting critter. They, like I said, they're the textbook example of an ecosystem engineer.
Well, and when a beaver creates a dam and creates this wetland, it's also not intended to be a permanent wetland that lasts forever, right?
Well, it probably depends who you ask.
Right.
I
Maybe
bet that beaver wouldn't mind
so,
that.
Right.
Yeah,
but these usually are kind of transient if you look over the long term.
Sure. Floods would impact beaver dams a lot. So, and then, of course, mortality of the beaver. If, for example, a coyote or something caught the beaver and killed it, there wouldn't be anything left there to maintain the beaver dam. But there is a legacy. You can find areas where generations of beavers maintain these wetland ecosystems, and as long as they're spared from flooding or widespread mortality of the population maintaining the dam, these things can stick around for a long time and like I said, and have really positive impacts on the wildlife around them, sort of disproportionately than other wildlife species tend to have on on others.
And if those dams do break or wash away, then the land that's left behind after there's been this wetland, that's usually richer soil, right? I mean, that replenishes the topsoil.
Yeah, it sure can. It, of course, holding water back changes the way that organisms break down vegetation, and wetlands, of course, grow a lot of vegetation themselves. And so, yeah, the soil can become more organic, particularly over a long time frame. So, beavers, they change it all. Insects, hydrology, other wildlife, fish, everybody is impacted by the impact, by the activity of beavers. And in some cases, producers are impacted when they build a dam in the middle of a drainage ditch.
Right. Fred, thank you so much for your call. Let's go back to the phones. Bob is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, you talked about the beavers being good engineers up upstream, slowing the flow and kind of allowing the flood events to be have lower peaks and taking out the flashiness of some of these flooding events. Can we pay farmers to do that upstream so that they can slow the flow and preserve the soil where it is already, and then slow the water coming downstream and prevent floodings in some of our urban centers?
All right, Bob, that's an interesting idea, and nobody here is going to be able to say whether we can pay farmers to do that or not. But, Scott, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, we have seen people purposely building wetlands to slow that flow, right?
Oh, exactly. You know, any farmer can go into a Natural Resource Conservation Service office and do just exactly what Bob is talking about. Some of the things that they can do is, you know, work on farm ponds, for instance, put in wetlands, even put in buffers or permanent vegetation along stream corridors. That is really crucial, is to get permanent vegetation along our stream corridors, and that will slow the flow. It'll slow the rainfall event from getting into our streams. Things like, you know, we have to live in a tiled society in Iowa, certainly to produce the type of crops we do. But potentially we have a lot of potential, I guess, into running some of these tiles into wetland areas. They don't have to be huge wetlands to make a big difference. Slowing the flow of water, taking out nutrients out of that water, which we hear so much about, I think that's where Iowa will go, tell you the truth. And it's a great question from Bob. But there are, and I challenge, you know, most farmers out there can go to a NRCS office and work at slowing the water that's coming through their property.
Well, and there was a recent article in the Cedar Rapids Gazette about a wetland north of Cedar Rapids on the Cedar River that some people are giving credit for really lessening the impact of this major flooding event that we just lived through on the city of Cedar Rapids. So from your perspective, Scott, do you see it working already?
You know, back, I used to work in the trout program back many, many years ago, and that's when the CRP program really kicked in, and that was the continuous reserve program. Mostly put grass into a lot of highly erodible soils, and we did see it. We saw it on our trout streams. We saw a big increase in our trout populations. We saw cleaner water, and we saw our trout respond a lot more natural reproduction. So it is possible. It's possible. We've seen small examples of it. We see it all the time when we slow the water into our major lakes that we create. If we slow the water down, we catch it in ponds, we catch the water in wetlands, as it naturally did. Some of these are engineered solutions, but they can be positive for water quality. They can maybe simulate those beaver dams you were talking about. You know, when we do those type of things, when we slow the water, when we clean the water, we have seen tremendous increases in places in our lakes and rivers where we've done that.
Well, and we haven't talked a lot about water quality and how these flooding events impact water quality. We'll have to do more of that when we come back after a break. But you're saying that if the water slows down, it's cleaner when it reaches bodies of water?
No doubt. We're catching the silt. And you know, when dirt gets into the water, it separates immediately. If you take a dirt clod and throw it in the water, it separates itself out immediately. The sands will drop, or the heavier stuff, the coarse material, drops out right away. But the things like silt and stuff move fast. They're very small. They move. You know, for the Mississippi River biologists, we deal with a lot of the silts that come out of our river system.
All right, and we'll have to pick up there after the break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Department of Natural Resources fisheries biologist Scott Gritters and Iowa State University Extension wildlife specialist Adam Janke. We're talking about major flooding events and how they interact with our ecology and wildlife. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about major flooding events, something that has become a lot more frequent in Iowa and many other places in recent decades, and how those flooding events impact our ecology and our wildlife, and also how our ecology can impact those flooding events. Department of Natural Resources fisheries biologist Scott Gritters is here, along with Iowa State University Extension wildlife specialist Adam Janke. He's also assistant professor in natural resource ecology and management. And Scott, I want to let you pick up where we left off. We were just talking about how flooding events impact water quality. And again, we were talking earlier about how so many things that we've done to our environment have increased the speed of the water as it travels through tributaries and into major rivers. And that speed has a big impact on the cleanliness of that water. So when we have an area with a wetland that maybe slows down the water, that kind of filters out the silt, and does that filter out other things as well?
Oh, certainly. Any particle that's, you know, heavy drops out first. So if you look at a stream, you know, a lot of times on the up part, you see you see things like rocks and boulders and cobble. That just means the sand and the silt is out of that soil. If you look at a lot of our inland streams now, we see a lot of sand, right? When we do finally get to low water, we see these big waves of sand. And you cross a river like the Wapsipinicon or the Maquoketa, you just see these miles and miles of these sand waves. Well, that's just simply either rocks that have been now covered up by sand, or the rocks have fallen out upstream and the silt has moved downstream and we're left with the sand component in the middle. But any time we slow the water, it'll stop all those things, the silts, the sands, and the rocks. And it generally is a very positive way to improve our water quality, improve our wildlife, and improve our fisheries in the state.
Now, of course, you don't have to necessarily, as a farmer or a landowner, you don't necessarily have to restore a wetland to slow that water down. How effective are buffer strips, the kinds of things that we see along creeks in rural areas where maybe native plants have been planted just in a fairly narrow strip along the edge of a creek?
Very effective, and I can probably, Adam probably has the exact figures, but you can definitely tell. And as we talked earlier in the show, especially if you get native vegetation with that deep root system, especially native grasses, you know, they are very good at holding the soil. And the other thing about a grass, when it floods over a streamway, a lot of times the grass will lay down and it'll actually protect the soil after a major flood event, and then pop up again after the flood is gone. So they can have a very, very large impact on our ecology and our water quality.
And now let's talk about how animals interact with this environment. So, you know, we talked about earlier how often there's high water in the springtime, and that, of course, a lot of animals maybe have evolved to interact with that higher water. But when the water gets really high, it can cause really significant problems. From your perspective, Adam, what time of year does a flood have the most impact on wildlife?
Well, if we're talking about negative impacts on wildlife, I would think that we would probably be most concerned about major flood pulses during the breeding season. So late spring and early summer would probably be the time where I would expect to see some for example, reptile nests or amphibian breeding ponds, or and then bird nests in riparian areas and woodland areas to be sort of negatively affected by floodwaters. Then, of course, if we talk about positive impacts, there's sort of winners and losers in all different times of the year when things flood. Anytime we put water back into wetlands, and floodplains are lined with wetlands, or what we call oxbows, areas where the channel used to be, but the channel shifted away and it leaves sort of a depression where we have a functioning wetland that's fed by floodwaters. Lots of animals benefit from filling those types of ecosystems. For example, migratory birds or amphibians or reptiles, particularly if the water persists into the next breeding season, where they can really take advantage of it for raising young or laying eggs.
So there can be positive and negative impacts. If we see really high floodwaters, I know we see a lot of young getting separated from in the spring or early summer, not only nests getting flooded, but young getting separated from their parents, things like that. The flash flooding events can have a big impact, a big negative impact on wildlife.
Right. And I think I was thinking about this and preparing for this. I think you can make predictions about how much a flood will impact a critter based on how mobile it is. If these things, for example, can swim through the floodwaters and get to upland areas that have suitable habitat, lots of things wouldn't be negatively affected. But things that are sort of tied to a specific landscape element or aren't able to move, like fly or swim across the top of the water, could really be affected. And I was reading a study in preparing for this about flooding impacts and on mammals, and the species that was most affected by big flood pulses, this was a study in Illinois, was groundhogs. And that makes a lot of sense because they had a burrow that they've invested a lot of time and energy into digging these burrows and where they raise their young and live. And when the floodwaters come, it displaces them out of the burrows, and they simply just don't have the time and energy to dig an all-new burrow while those floodwaters cover up their where they were before. And then, of course, they succumb to predation or starvation or things like that. So birds, large animals that can either swim or can just walk away from the coming floodwaters. Of course, it isn't a huge sheet of water coming down the floodplain. So as the floodwaters come, if animals can move away and they're relative habitat generalists, they can find a place to sleep and they can find a place to feed, then they probably aren't too negatively affected.
Now, do animals, I mean, you're talking about burrowing animals, do they burrow in floodplains, or is that something that many different species just know to avoid?
Well, right. It would probably depend on how frequently the area floods, and I think it would really depend on how moist the soil was and the absence of surface water. So, yeah, a lot of these areas that we're talking about flooding are wet to the touch all year round. And of course, that's not a suitable burrowing area, but there's lots of sort of topography within a lot of floodplains. And so you see banks where a lot of animals will burrow that are dry. And of course, there's lots of food. Lots of these animals use the river as food sources, like raccoons and lots of natural vegetation down there for other burrowing animals like groundhogs. So there is certainly a lot of burrowing probably going on in floodplains. But again, a lot of these animals would be resilient to these flood impacts and just be able to sort of move away, find refuge in a dry area, and then come back.
And Scott, let's talk about fish, because I think most of us think, oh, fish are not going to be negatively impacted by a flood. Water's great for fish, right?
Well, you know, and again, you know, it's like you were talking about with wildlife. Sometimes it's a, you know, a glass half full, glass half empty thing. A major flood, especially if it's not a flash flood, can actually be real positive for fish. Fish like catfish commonly move right along the edge of the floodplain, right along the flooded water edge, because there's a lot of insects that can be now had that they didn't have a chance at before, right? And even big floods, like, you know, even the catastrophic floods like the ones that occurred in Cedar Rapids, a migratory fish, a current fish like maybe a shovelnose sturgeon, to them that's a good deal. They can get over the dams there in Cedar Rapids, and they can now exploit hundreds of miles of river that were, prior to that, were off limits to them. So, yes, flooding can be a really positive thing. But there's certain times a year when floods probably are negative. And we experienced that one I alluded to last year, a flood in the middle of the winter on the Mississippi. And we saw from radio transmitted fish, fish that are way in the backwaters that are in really quiet areas of the Mississippi and areas that are deep enough for them to live through the winter, but, they don't get froze out of. All of a sudden, the Mississippi rose to, I think, the highest we've seen in January on record, and all of a sudden now those fish were displaced, and we saw high mortality rates of those type of fish. So, again, timing of the year can be a huge factor.
Well, and to return to the conversation about water quality, if a major flooding event washes a lot of pollutants into a river, a lake, or a stream, you can have a definite negative impact with that as well.
You know, it's amazing how much nutrients and silt enters the river. I know many years ago I did a study on the Maquoketa River, and I gave plenty of talks on this. And at that time, the rate of sedimentation out of a small stream like the Maquoketa River into the Mississippi was about 2 dump truck loads of silt every 15 minutes. It's literally a conveyor belt of silt. But if you looked over the time span of a whole year, most of that silt and sand entered the Mississippi in about a 7-day period. If we could stretch the whole timeline out, if we could eliminate 77 days out of that time frame, we could eliminate, I think, up to maybe 80% of the silt entering the river.
The flooding events have been impacted by a lot of different changes in our environment, although I think that there is a basic understanding that this is one of the symptoms of climate change in the United States. So, Scott, as you research the different species that you work with as a fisheries biologist, what are some of the other impacts that you see from climate change?
Well, you know, again, climate change interacts with what all these other things that you mentioned, you know, altered hydrology of our rivers, the tiling that went through, the pothole. So, you know, climate change is just one more impact to that. And it's really hard to separate out what's caused by climate change versus urbanization versus, some of these other landscape changes. And that's what makes it so difficult for scientists to say, hey, climate change caused this. Certainly there's been an impact of all these things on our fisheries and our mussels in the state. And a lot of times, to tell you the truth, Charity, there are a lot of species that are affected are the species we know least about. Our non-game species, our mussel species, I think we just went through a process of identifying our species the greatest conservation need. And, you know, fully 93% of our mussels that used to inhabit Iowa, which I think there was like 52 species, 93% now we've listed as species the greatest conservation need. And I think 54% of our fish species. And a lot of these species are things that nobody has ever heard about or real special species. But, you know, all these changes have impacted them, as well as other changes. We've modified the landscape or the river systems in other ways, damming, straightening. We've taken a toll on our water bodies, and our species show it.
Adam, what about the species that you research and climate change?
Yeah, there's a lot of work going on in that arena, of course, and the species that I'm most familiar with are migratory birds, and we worry about with migratory birds is sort of the changes in seasons latitudinally. So if you can, we of course know that climate change is, the impacts of climate change are sort of magnified at the poles, and lots of migratory birds that are moving through Iowa right now are returning from areas close to the poles. In fact, yesterday I was out and saw a flock of greater white-fronted geese, and these birds are almost certainly coming from the north slope of Alaska. So that's the north side of Alaska, the very tip of North America, and they're moving to Arkansas for breeding. And those birds have evolved to pick up on signals in Arkansas that will tell them whether or not their breeding areas in the north slope of Alaska are ready for them in terms of vegetation growth, insects and availability for the young, or actually grass growth availability for the young in the case of white-fronted geese. And they use those cues at southern latitudes to know when they need to go back north. And what we worry about is that there's going to be changes in the north that progress quicker than changes in the south. And we call that the mismatch hypothesis. And basically that means that birds in Arkansas, for example, or Iowa, aren't going to know that they need to be in the Arctic. Or they may not even be able to make it to the Arctic because the conditions at the mid-latitudes aren't quite as advanced as they are at the northern latitudes. And that has that's a big area of concern for migratory birds and climate changes, is how the cues that these birds have evolved to pick up on are going to change across these wide geographic scales that they experience in their life cycle. So lots of really big picture challenges for climate change and migratory birds. And bringing it back to the flooding thing is just climate change predicts increased severity of extreme weather events.
So flooding and droughts.
Exactly. More pulses, more droughts, and then also changes in the seasonality of precipitation patterns. We don't get the big snowpacks potentially that brought a lot of that spring flooding we've been talking about. And instead, we've sort of traded that in, so to speak, for early summer, midsummer precipitation patterns when lots of young are around and they're not accustomed to these big flooding events. So lots of changes, and we try to make predictions about what these things may, how these things may play out, and then we try to develop conservation strategies that can help these species deal with these challenges that they probably won't be able to keep up with sort of evolutionarily.
Well, and Scott, as you spend time working on the Mississippi, dealing with these major weather events and the water quality challenges, what gives you hope as you look into the future? Because I imagine you need to have some hope to keep going.
Oh, certainly. You know, some of the hope that I see is, you know, things like sedimentation. You know, we know how to deal with that. We can. We've got examples out there on our landscape right now that have worked. We need to carry them over to the big picture. You know, do it throughout Iowa and the Midwest. But that gives me hope. We've got some areas that are already successful. The other thing, things like sedimentation, you know, we're talking about nitrogen and phosphorus, and those are natural elements. We're not at least talking about, you know, mercury and gold mining and all those other really hard to tackle pollutants. So that gives me some hope. It's things that are natural.
Scott Gritters, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me again.
DNR fisheries biologist Scott Gritters and Adam Jenke, thank you.
Yes, thank you. It was a great time.
Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist Adam Jenke. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Please get out and vote today.